Philosophy. Descartes. Debate. The Mep Report. Mep Report. Mep Report. The awesomest discussion podcast in the history of the human species.
Oh, yeah!
Let me tell you of an interview with an old man emu. He's got a beak and feathers and things, but the poor old fella ain't got no wings. Aren't you jealous of the wedge-tailed eagle? Well, the eagle's flying round and round to keep my 2 feet firmly on the ground. Now, I can't fly, but I'm telling you, I could run the pants off a kangaroo. But he can't fly, but I'm telling you, he can run the pants off a kangaroo.
All right, in that case, welcome to the Mep Report number 164, May 31st. It's 5 minutes before it goes into June, so we did make May a recording. Yes. Anyway, 2020. So we're here, and for those of you listening to this only a couple of weeks in the future, maybe, you know, we hope that everyone is okay and that you your house is still standing
and that there's a planet on which
you are still standing. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. But welcome, everybody. Yeah, well, apparently, you know, what I heard was that apparently the president has been on several occasions brought down to his White House bunker because of the protests outside. This was actually reported by several groups over the last couple of days. I think the Times reported it that, you know, he went down to the bunker last night and then tweeted out some stuff about how these deadly guard dogs, which apparently are, you know, these Secret Service guard dogs that I've never heard about that are specially trained to take out protesters and not part of his own MAGA crowd.
Could he be really more of a comic book villain if he tried?
I know. Isn't it amazing? It really is amazing. It's what makes me wonder about whether the simulation theory about that we're all in a simulation is true, because it just seems like so, like eventually the world just devolves into silliness and like absurdity and like like you're in a bunker. Like, who has there ever been a president? I was thinking about this watching John Adams, which admittedly, of course, a film, but is based on historical realities. There's this one scene where John Adams is talking to George Washington shortly after he signed the Jay Treaty, which basically said that America would not go into war in favor of France and against Great Britain, which was very unpopular at the time because everyone was thinking about, you know, the French helped us and, you know, they had the French ambassador was getting the people all riled up over here. So they wanted to go help the French. So it was very unpopular. So they had people like literally outside his house with like these two hapless revolutionary guard, not revolutionary at that point, but you know, like early American guards, like 1790s, whatever it was, standing in front of his house and like torches outside and pitchforks and like him being hung in effigy and all this stuff and big glass windows. And he's having this big speech talking to John Adams about like, well, the hellhounds are in full cry and all this stuff. Now, obviously they dramatized that slightly, but it is true that there were protests right outside George Washington's house with people, pitchforks and flames and torches. And he did not go running somewhere to some, like I just...
Oh, for a second, I thought you were making a parallel between him and George Washington.
No. Why? No. I'm making a parallel only in the sense of, like, the difference between presidential demeanor, I guess. Yeah. Like, you know, Mr. Like, I am the bravest of the brave, and I will now go running to the bunker because for the first time that I can remember, I'm going to a bunker to hide from my own people who are protesting me. You know, not I'm going down there because of possible attack or I'm going down there because of this, but because I'm afraid of people chanting don't shoot and Black Lives Matter. And because of that, I need to go and justice for George Floyd. And so I need to go run to my bunker. Like, just come on, man. Like, it's just.
Yeah. Can we give a quick overview for alien salvaging?
Yes. Let us do that. Yes.
2,500.
Let's do that. Do you want to give the summary or you want me to? Or story.
So we've been podcasting since late 2005. Is that
yes.
right? And it's like not even close. This is like by far the darkest like period in our history that we've ever even. I mean, we've gone through like Katrina, Ferguson, economic crashes. Yep. We're a few years past 9/11, which had happened already.
Yep.
But I mean, this is like blowing everything out of the water.
Yeah. In the 15-year history of the show, I would say that's accurate. I would say race riots plus economic collapse plus pandemic equals darkest timeline.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's pretty uncontroversial. Like for anyone who's in a position to be alive, except for maybe the aliens during this period of time hearing this. I think,
nowhere to go but up, guys.
That's not necessarily true.
Okay, that's fair. You know, let's be clear. Let's hope there's nowhere to go but up. You're right.
To give the short
I apologize
version,
to fate.
No, it's okay.
So I live in the Mid-Wilshire area where there were, you know, there was a nonviolent protest followed by a bunch of weirdness and ended up in a night of looting and destroying buildings, you know, blocks away from where I live. And there's like SWAT and National Guard and fire engines and burning shit. And, you know, I'm sitting here with my two kids trying to protect them and distract them and everything.
Yeah.
And I'm so tired because I didn't sleep last night that I forgot where I was going with the statement, other than just to give a quick summary of like where I'm at in regards to.
So it's a summary of you really at the moment. Right. Like, this is where you're at, right?
Like, oh, I remember. Okay. So I had this thought while I was like racing through Twitter and watching every video available and reading it. And I was just like, it's so hard when you're in the middle of something like this to know where you are in the trajectory of the thing.
Yes.
You know, it's like, yeah. Is it like, this is clearly the bottom, or you really could get way worse than this. And you have absolutely no idea. Like, there's no way to just look around and cause you, the only thing that you have is a comparison to past events. And we've gone so far past any precedent for what events might look like that, like nothing is not a possibility. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Right. Nothing's ruled out. Yeah.
Right. Nothing's ruled out. So my question, because that's like, you know, as a dad and as a head of family, I'm like, do we try to just go to New Zealand right now? Is this the time to just leave?
Is this the moment? Yeah. Is this the call where it's, I mean, all right.
And if it is, it's too late, and I should have done it back when I told you guys danger was coming in January.
Yeah.
But,
yeah,
it's just hard. It's just hard to know things like that.
You're totally right. I've thought a lot about this idea of the difficulty of being able to, I don't think we're good at understanding sort of generation defining events when you're in the middle of them. You know, I mean, it's because again, like you're right in the midst of it. And so it's hard to see, you're in the middle of a forest. It's hard to see what's happening on the ends of the forest in a way. But if the forest itself is moving, I was just reading Two Towers to my daughter before starting the show. And so it's the part where they're Fangorn and Treebeard and the Ents are marching to Isengard. And it's hard to imagine being in the midst of something like that. But I mean, you know, as we said with the pandemic, you know, this is the equivalent, this is our World War II. You know, we've never had an event that was this all-encompassing. And this combination of events seems wholly unprecedented. Now, I'm not going to go so far as to say, I mean, the Spanish flu in 1918 was also during the time of World War I and was also during the time of a serious economic downturn before the Roaring Twenties. And then obviously we know what happened after that. So, I mean, I don't want to go so far as to say that this is the most consequential time in the history of the planet. I think that's probably too far to say. But it's definitely the most consequential time. I'm 47. I mean, I was alive for the fall of the Berlin Wall, and I was aware, I was old enough to be aware of the implications of that. And that was enormous. I mean, no question. Mm-hmm. But it's, you know, I guess this is what I think I would say. I wonder what you guys think about this. I feel like what this is clearly the sort of most consequential and at the moment darkest time that has been openly reported about and available to us, you know, because in 1989, 1990, 1991, when the Berlin Wall is falling, that's getting covered by mainstream media, but there is no internet there. Not any internet in the way we understand it. That is way before social media. There's no kind of real time assessment other than just looking at what you're looking at in TV and maybe calling up family members and maybe talking about it the next day at school. But the immediacy of it and the overwhelming nature of it is something which isn't there. And so on the one hand, that can cause shutdown, right? Because you can just be like, oh my God, there's too much information for me to process all at once. But then on the other hand, there is a sense therefore that we're able to witness things that we might not have been able to witness previous to this. I mean, for how many hundreds of years have black men been executed by white privileged people, and particularly police and those in authority? That is part of America's founding. It's its fundamental aspect of America, is it is a country founded on bigotry and racism. So how long has that been going on? And it's not like this is the first time that it ever started happening. But as Will Smith said, racism isn't new. It's just getting filmed. And that, I think, is something that's maybe more powerful, is that we're not only in the middle of the moment, but we are aware somehow that this is a huge moment, and we don't know how huge or where it's going to go, but we're all aware of it at the same time. And that may be what's leading us to this sort of experience, is that it's not just that we're going through it, but that we know that we're going through something, and everyone is talking about it, and what does that sort of do to us? So I don't know if you guys feel that way, but I wonder how much just being aware that everyone else is aware that we're going through something is a part of this feel. I don't know, this experience.
Yes, it's unnerving to me because I pride myself on always being super prepared, especially for when the shit hits the fan, and just having a ton of information at my disposal to draw on.
Right.
But it's like things are so fluid right now that I'm kind of at a loss. I mean, I don't even know if we're getting into the predictions phase, because we've barely gotten into the analysis phase of like what's actually happening. So I don't even want to start with predictions, but it's like, it feels like a big, huge overcompensation is about to happen. And there's just like, we're not going to be living in regular America for a while because rights are going to be suspended all over the place.
Yeah. I mean, I think
as a beginning salvo.
Yeah. I mean, I think I talked in the last show about the jump ball with Hitler concept. And like, I feel like everything that's happened since has just intensified the jump ball with Hitler, which, if you didn't hear that show, or if I'm misremembering it, like, is basically this concept of like grand upheaval leads to incredible change opportunity. And it can be,
yeah,
in many ways, the times of the most swift and positive change for the better. But the uncertainty and the ambiguity and the challenge of those times makes it equally likely that things change for much worse. And so you're in this jump ball with Hitler at center court of just like, well, things are either going to get a lot better or a lot worse. Like, really hope we can jump and get to the ball before Hitler. And like, you know, I went to the protest yesterday in Pittsburgh, and I really, you know, it felt like in seeing some of the conflicts happen with protesters and police and seeing how police were responding to that, you could just see both sides of it. You could feel the enormous opportunity and hope and solidarity, especially emerging from the pandemic, which, you know, people were wearing masks and people were social distancing as much as they could. The social distancing was not up to protocol, but the mask wearing was like 99%. It was very impressive, much better than anywhere in West Virginia for recreation.
I said to Story Russ before this, by the way, that this is the one example where like pandemic and protest comes together. Like, everyone gets, yeah, a mask. Like,
exactly.
It's cool to wear a mask right now.
Oh, yeah. And there were people, I mean, there were people who had shopping carts of supplies that were like giving out free water and snacks, but also like, you know, but also masks.
Yeah,
just had,
yeah,
like tons of extra masks, and would go up to people if they saw them, you know, the one out of 150 people who weren't wearing a mask and saying like, here, have a mask.
Yeah.
So, you know, so you have that groundswell of feeling, and then you turn a corner and see just how many people are marching ahead of you. And it's like, wow, this is like really a movement. Like, things really can change. A better world is possible. And then, you know, you start to see the anger in the police and people scattering and the police yelling at everybody, you know, and it's just like, and this is what the interests who want to defend the horrible aspects of the status quo will do, you know? And so, you just, it felt like that real time of like, oh yeah, this is what, you know, this is what happens when there's a level of upheaval to create real change, is it could get better or it could get worse. And you don't know what the trajectory is or where you're at in it. And so it's very exciting and very scary.
It's well said. I think it's, you know, it strikes me that there's been a lot of discussion from historians that I find history has been strangely comforting to me in this time, maybe not so strangely, like learning, mm-hmm, what we've been through before. And, one of the things that's been really amazing to see is that how many times things felt inevitable until they weren't. You know, and so I think about that very short period of time in the, I guess, gosh, I have to look it up now, late 80s, early 90s, when Gorbachev was thrown out of power for a very brief period of time. And there was a coup, basically. Mm-hmm. And these Russian military leaders took over. And I remember that was the first time in my life that I had been fully aware. And of course, I've argued for a long time that the reason that the 80s were so weird is because we were living on the hair trigger of Armageddon, and that just creates, but no one talked about it, you know, so it's just, there's a manifest oddness about the 1980s that is driven by the fact that within, you know, we could have been dead within minutes, all of us forever. Right. And like, you know, so that creates this real oddness about the world. And I think contributes to some of Generation X's paranoia about things. But anyway, so, and I, that was the first time that I was conscious of the fact that, you know, we could die, all die right then. And I remember going to my parents and being like, are we all going to die? Like, what is going to happen? And that thing ended within a day or two. Like, it almost immediately fell apart, and then was immediately followed by the Soviet Union falling apart. And there was a time where it was seen as inevitable that we would destroy ourselves, like from that, I mean, and we didn't. Mm-hmm. And then there was a time where it was inevitable that the Soviet Union and the United States would always exist as these two bipolar, you know, power. And then until it wasn't anymore. Right. And like, so I was reading today on Twitter, Dan Rather, who, by the way, has been awesome. Dan, follow Dan Rather if you haven't already. Cause like, as a guy who now is sort of unfettered by the sort of general mainstream media, like he just has his own sources and he's like a journalist with like, God, 60 years of experience or whatever. So right. he knows how to do this stuff. There's two people like that that I really love. He's one of them. The other one is a guy that Russ probably knows, called Al Giordano. Both story. Actually, I don't know. You might know him too, Story. I don't know, but
I don't.
Big on like,
I'm not familiar.
Big on labor movement. You, Russ, would especially love Giordano because he writes about the narcotics trade and like specifically why, who gets money out of making it into the war that it is, and like South America, like really good stuff. I've actually had an exchange with him about over Twitter about Ted Cruz and my having debated him once, and him being like, you did, you know, like one of these like random, but anyway, yeah, so he's really cool. You should check him out. But Dan Rather had this tweet that I want to read, and it said, that was actually from this morning. And it said, in 1968, there was a sense proven by subsequent elections that those taking to the streets in pain and protest were a minority of the country, and the levers of power in business, government, and culture were arrayed against them. I do not get that sense in 2020. Now, Rather is always really, really careful about the way that he sort of presents conclusions. But when he does present a conclusion, he's right almost always about the conclusion that he draws. And I found that fascinating because essentially what that suggests is exactly what you said, Story, that this is, you know, jump ball for Hitler. And we really as a species need to stop doing that. However, it is not the case that Hitler has already gotten the ball and is going up for the dunk. That is not the case. Yeah. And the fact that I do feel that there is a palpable sense, even from the reaction from white America, you get a little bit of that whole, like, you know, well, we got to stop the damn lawlessness. Like, you get a little bit of that bullshit that is just tiresome. But truthfully, a lot of what you get is, and before I go on, it is not tiresome to say, I don't, you know, we should not be going around and blowing up buildings and destroying people's, like, but I just really would love us first to center people over property. I would really love it if we could do that. I would really love it if the first thing we think about is not, oh my God, that Target got burned down. And instead, oh my God, we killed another innocent black man execution style, as we have done literally millions of times. So maybe we could talk about them just for a second before we talk about property. But anyway, but I get this sense that, so having said that caveat, I don't want to make it seem like there's nothing compared to that. But the effect of people coming together in this sense, most of what I've seen reactions from people, not on leftist Twitter, not even on social media per se, but just reactions that you get from various places, suggests that there is not this overwhelming repudiation. Like, even from white America, there's a lot of people who are like, yeah, like this was just wrong. And I don't know if it's the way that it was done because of the video that was just so incredibly obvious, but we've had obvious videos before, or if it's partially because of the pandemic, because everyone is just more both burned out and tired, but also sensitive to this. Like, it feels as if they can identify with being pressed this way. I don't know. But whatever it is, it feels to me like a vastly different experience where the reaction has not just been, well, there's a bunch of violent people. And whenever you see, you know, Trump and his morons coming up with stuff like, oh, well, it's Antifa, all they get is roundly mocked. Like, just like, you know, like it's almost like half of them ignore them. I saw a bunch of things today with a bunch of these police departments now that were marching with the protesters.
Yeah, I was going to bring that up.
And like,
yeah.
Now there's a bunch of policemen who were also continuing to be brutal. And I get that PR. And I think the police needs to be 1,000% reformed. I get it. But that would never have happened. Even in Ferguson, it didn't happen. Can you imagine the department taking off their helmets? Can you imagine a Secret Service officer, this was also on video, saying to the people outside the protesters, to the protesters outside the White House, when I take this suit off, I'm just as black without it, and I march with you. Can you imagine a Secret Service person ever say, what? You know, like, I'm staggered by that. And so it does feel different to me somehow. And, you know, who knows where we go with it. And we have to be aware that it can be taken over at any moment for other purposes. But it just doesn't feel as much of a blowback as I thought there would be against it. And maybe we can try to start getting something done. I don't know. I feel as awful as I feel about all of this and as dark as it feels, there's a strange sense of hope at the bottom of this for me, and I don't know where that's coming from, but I feel a little bit of it.
Hey, that's great. Don't fight it. Don't fight that.
Stop being hopeful, Greg.
Yeah.
I don't know.
There's so much to unpack. I want to talk to you guys about like nine different things.
Tell me.
And I want to push your buttons for the first time in the show. And
I'm outstanding. I'm prepared to have my buttons pushed.
Good. Here come the button pushing. So,
okay.
It's like, strangely, especially in LA, I feel like over the last 3 or 4 days, once the protests have gotten into full force, in a weird way, it feels like the pandemic is just not a big deal anymore, even though it obviously is.
I was going to say, it will be in about like, 2 weeks.
It is.
Right. We know that these could all be super spreader events, etc. But it's just like people are acting like it's kind of, you know, in the way that we go through the news cycle every 5 seconds, it's like, well, we did the pandemic for 2 months. Like, get over it. Right? Like, we're on to the race war now. But so here's my question. And so this was like widely, you know, denounced and dismissed, the idea that there was any other solution to this than going into full lockdown. When we listened to the medical experts who told us that, I mean, and to be totally fair to the medical experts, they did not have a lot of good solutions available, right? Like, we did not have advanced preparation. We did not have a read on this virus. We did not have advanced vaccines or advanced technologies or tracking or tracing or anything. And they're like, well, we don't have anything at our disposal, really. So we're going to do this thing that worked 100 years ago. And that's going to be our best tool against this pandemic,
right?
Which is going into lockdown. If you could see the future and you knew that the trajectory that we were on in March 15th, when most of America started, or the responsible states in America started putting themselves on lockdown, and then you could look forward to June 1st, would you still have gone on lockdown if you knew what was going to happen? Because I would argue that, yes, obviously there was a horrible murder, but I don't know that that was the cause of everything that's going on right now as much as it was the catalyst for a powder keg that had already been created.
Well, created by what, though?
Created by decades of oppression, but also created by 40 million people who are unemployed, depressed, sitting at home, not having any outlets in their lives, not being allowed to do anything, not being allowed to see each other or talk to each other or be in groups of any kind.
Yes.
And the release that a lot of the protesters have been expressing that they felt once they are able to take the streets, I think is in part because of the empowerment of being in a protest, and in part because they've been starved for companionship for 2 months because they've gone through the whole Netflix catalog and they're done with it. And there's nothing left on Netflix to watch. And so it's an amazing feeling to be able to be with other people. And so, and I think it is 100% a symptom of being locked down for 2 months.
Well, first of all, maybe this is coming later. None of what you said pushes any of my buttons. Like I totally agree with you that that the pandemic has had a profound effect. I do, however, have a little bit of a more, well, I don't want to say hopeful because I'm not sure if you're being hopeful about it, but my answer is yes. I would still say we would have to be in lockdown for two reasons. One, because the only reason that New York, where I am right now, the only reason that we escaped even worse disaster, and it was pretty disastrous as it was. I mean, tens of thousands of people have died as a consequence of all of this. And as we know, over 103,000 people just reported deaths, and the number is actually way higher. You know, it's probably like 130, 140,000 people in America right now. So because we did such a colossally bad job, and I mean colossally bad, at the, which is amazing. If you elect people that tell you that government shouldn't do anything, it's amazing how often they are incapable of doing anything when they have government. It's amazing. But so they did a disastrous job. So the only thing we could do is lockdown, because without that, everything that you're seeing would have been far worse. Like, you would have had no healthcare system in New York at all. You would have had no, like, they're the overwhelming nature of it. Because just by buying this time, what we have been able to learn about just COVID-19, about the fact that it doesn't just affect the old, which is what we heard initially, that it isn't just respiratory, that there is a suggestion now, a strong suggestion, that it, what it really is a vascular disease, that it really goes after vessels, and that that's one of the reasons why it presents in these different ways, because it affects, it starts in the lungs, but then it ends up in blood vessels. And that has a profound effect. It means that antivirals don't do a whole lot, but it also means that we have a lot of already pre-existing treatments that can do a great deal of good against this. The fact that we've now learned intubations are way down, partly because we've learned that intubations don't do a lot most of the time for this, and that what's much better is what's called proning, which is just literally to put people on their stomachs so that the lungs expand differently. Like, this is all stuff that we didn't know when we were in the middle of a war zone. And if we had not locked down and dropped numbers so that New York is the only state where the numbers are dropping precipitously, whereas everywhere else it's either plateaued or spiking in Texas, in Georgia, in Florida, even with the fact that they report, they're not reporting everything, all that stuff. That gave us time, and that gave time for a bunch of these vaccine trials to proceed and all that. So I still would have done that in a health reason. But the other reason, to go directly to your point, Russ, is here's why else I think it was good. Because I think the fact that everyone is sitting at home unemployed has ripped the veneer off of the nonsense that we have told each other about who profits and who doesn't in this economy, about the fact that now there, it is now the case that most of middle America is getting the sense that the stock market is 100% divorced from actual economic benefit to anyone who matters. And that on its own is enormous, right? The fact that they now look at these numbers and go, yeah, whatever, I still lost my job. I mean, you know, Story has been beating the drum on actual unemployment numbers for a decade or more, right? And now all of a sudden everyone's like, well, this is bullshit. Like, I'm unemployed, my friend's unemployed. Mm-hmm. So if anything, I think what this has done is, I think you're right. I think it meant that a lot of people are so pissed off and tired and at home that this is an expression of rage. But I think it's an expression of rage at the system. And I think that that promises to be very, very good if we can play that in the right way. You know, it's rage at the system that needs to exist for change to happen. And so I don't know that that would have happened if we didn't have everyone feeling connected with everyone else because they were all equally affected and because they felt like this economic system is bullshit and the racial system we have in this country is bullshit. And that, you know, so many things that we learned, these fairy tales are now shown to be bullshit. And I think that you're seeing a reaction to bullshit. So in a way, I feel like that's a positive thing. So, you know, as awful as it's been to be going through this and as awful as it's been for everyone who's had to suffer, even far worse than the three of us have even to this point. If one of the results of it is that it brings us to an understanding of reality and it brings us to understand that the system as currently constituted can't be preserved in this way, you know, we're all talking about universal basic income. The Wall Street Journal is talking about the need for universal basic income. That is not something that would have happened. And that happened in 3 months. It didn't take three decades. It happened in 3 months. So that's profound, it seems to me. So again, was it worth all those people dying? No. But if we're going to have those people dying, then one positive that came out of it was this. So I think the lockdown was, you know,
I mean,
that's my view.
I don't mean to make a trade-off and go like, we need all these people to die.
I don't want to do that because
technological leap that's happening. No. I think the only reasonable alternative, which has been widely denounced, has been like the Sweden model, which is basically like, let people
let
as many healthy people as possible get it, try to develop herd immunity as quickly as you can, try to protect the vulnerable populace at nursing homes, etc.
Which has been an abject disaster in Sweden, by the
way. Well, an abject disaster to the tune of 40 deaths per 100,000 people. So I mean,
which is
in terms of
way above their countries, though. Their neighboring
it's
countries.
It's better than Italy. It's worse than Norway. You know what I mean? Like, it's worse than the Nordic neighbors, and it's better than the worst
cases
in the U.S.
though.
And Italy.
Vastly worse, though. I mean, it's not close worse. Sweden is being held up as a disaster.
And again, your comments about taking the veneer off of our political life notwithstanding. Like, if people could have just continued... I mean, again, we didn't have the information that we needed to really
proceed
this way.
Yeah.
But if we knew that the death rate was like 0.4% instead of 4%, then we might have decided people can still go to work with social distancing measures, which is what we're doing right now. You know, we have some level of herd immunity and we flatten the curve somewhat, but we're like, we have the hospital space to absorb more patients right now. So we're just like, let's phase into the reopening, even though nothing has fundamentally changed except that 5 to 10% of the population's already got the thing.
Right.
You know what I mean?
We don't have a vaccine yet, and it's not going to be changed until we have a vaccine.
And we won't for some time, yeah.
Right. You know, and that's one of the things that, like, yeah, I mean, but see, that's the thing, right? We didn't know at the time, and we could have been South Korea, which did everything with contact tracing and testing. And that's why whenever you hear things about, like, you know, well, China did this and we don't want to be like China. Okay, well then instead, how about you be a highly technologically advanced country with a top five economy, South Korea. We could be them. A lot of people, you know, similar demographics in terms of like similar demographics in terms of economics, much different environment and vastly different results. Why? Because they actually had contact tracing and testing because they had a vaguely competent government and they had people that went along with it. And I'm talking even per capita. I'm not talking about just, you know, raw numbers. I'm talking per capita. They are vastly different. So it could have been them. But if we were going to botch all of that the way that we did and we were going to have our leaders go golfing for 3 months, then the only thing we could do at that point was to just shut everything down, I think, until, because you're right, like nothing fundamentally has changed except we know more now than we did. And we also have bought 2 months where we're 2.5 months where we're that much closer to a vaccine. That said, we shouldn't be opening up and we shouldn't be opening up for another 6 months, frankly.
And also feel free to tell me if we're talking too much about the pandemic because it is yesterday's news at this point.
Well, it's all tied in, but it's all tied in, right? I mean, like you're right. These things are all of a piece. There's a sense of, you know, everything in a way kind of in breakdown mode. And so the question is, do you come out of it? I don't feel the wheels spinning off American society to the end of that society as much as I see that we, you know, we desperately need a pit stop. And then the question is, what's the pit stop? Is the pit stop the end of America, or, you know, in any functional sense, or is the pit stop the end of the way we ran America? And boy, are we overdue for that. You know, so if that's what comes out, then I don't know. I mean, because what Story said about marching in that movement, I understand that it's hard when you're in a group of 1,000 people. You can feel like you're part of a movement if 330 million people are arrayed against you. But I don't know. You know, I watched video after video after video of, as I say, cops marching with protesters. I watched video after video of protesters. I saw this thing. I don't know if you guys saw this. This is not, by the way, to lionize cops. Police reform is 1,000% overdue. All I'm talking about is the kind of historical moment. I saw it was in Portland, and a bunch of these cops took a knee, like literally kneeled in front of the protesters. I've never seen anything like it. And the protesters, so what did they do? They came up to them, shook their hands. You know, they were all filming it. Like there's cell phones, camera phones everywhere. They were all, you know, shook their hands, were sort of singing in solidarity, were then going on Twitter and talking about how cool this was. That's extraordinary to me. And so you can say, well, it's all PR, not you, but like someone could say, oh, it's all PR. Who cares? Maybe it is. Maybe the reason that Gorbachev, you know, advanced the ball of nuclear disarmament and advanced the ball of world peace and took us away from the hair trigger of Armageddon is not because, as he always said it was, because his granddaughter sat on his knee and said, "Grandpa, are you going to destroy the world?" But maybe it's just because he did it because he felt like they couldn't handle it economically and he wanted to get a Nobel Prize. Who the hell knows? I don't care. All I know is that the end result of it was we were farther away from destruction than we had been before he did that. And so if the result of all of these things is that it's become uncool to brutalize, that can't be anything but positive. And so I have this sense that both from the pandemic and from, you know, this current situation, we have an opportunity before us that I feel like more people are hearing. Maybe because they have time, you know, even when they're at home and unemployed. A lot of these people, I was reading an article about this, who have come to the conclusion that they don't, obviously they need money, but so many of them are like, I don't need to be defined by my work. You know, like, why did I ever need to work 100 hours a week? Why was it ever an expectation that I should never have any time off, that I shouldn't ever be able to take time for myself? What if I imagined my life in a different way? That's an incredible, you know,
100% to that. I mean,
you know what I mean?
My personal schedule was just pre-pandemic was just like going to work, coming home, seeing the kids, comedy show, you know, podcast, going to work, going back, like going to a class, going to an improv show. I literally never stopped moving. I was exhausted all the time.
Yeah.
Ever since this started, I've basically been at home and in the neighborhood 99% of the time. I've spent a ton more time with my kids. I still feel like I'm like overloaded and crazy busy just because a lot of my work is remote and it's of the nature of like doesn't need to be in an office. So I get my hour of commute time back and get to spend it with my kids. But yeah, it's hard to imagine going back to that mode of just like and
yeah,
justifying it.
Yeah, it's just extraordinary to me. Like, I don't know, Story, do you feel like, I feel like even with the sort of, for you, it was a little bit different because you were dealing with first teaching and studying and obviously and doing writing. So that's a little more, but I don't know if it feels different for you, but it sure as hell feels different to me, just everything in terms of schooling, education, whether we homeschool, Senevine, yeah, fall, you know, all that stuff.
No, different. I mean, my life has changed the least because of the pandemic, by far. So, you know, like my job, my 20-hour week job went online, and then I went, you know, my classes went online, and one of them was asynchronous. So basically functionally ended except for like reading and writing stuff on my own. But I've also like always tried to live my life with as a guardian of my time and my schedule and not prioritizing money at any point. And so, you know, like, I do see a lot of evidence that a lot of other people are kind of, you know, waking up as judgmental, but, you know, coming around to, or feeling empowered to come around to that situation. And that was one of the first opportunities I saw with just the pandemic was just like, oh, well, you know, now we can reshape the world the way that it should have been a long time ago, because people will, the veneer will be off about what is so-called essential, because we've been told throughout our lifetimes that everything that if the market wants it, it's essential, right? That everything that is created by a capitalist system, no matter how wasteful, how destructive of the planet, how destructive of Black lives or anybody else's lives, it is. It's essential because everything is essential in capitalism and everything is equally good. And as long as the market said it should happen, then it's good. And obviously this is total garbage, but it has become the religious affiliation of most of the country to just believe that the market operates this way magically. So to see, and 2008 like should have ended it and came very close to doing, right? Like 2008, like if they had adhered to the rules of the system, it would have collapsed just like the Soviet Union collapsed and it all would have changed and been over.
Yep.
But they just threw the switch and threw everything at it and, you know, did these unconscionable things that are violations of any belief in the market to save the market. And they're like, well, this is what you have to do sometimes. And it's like, well, doesn't that violate the whole philosophy? Never mind. So that, you know, that bought
exactly
12 years, as it turns out. But then you have any other challenge like this pandemic and the veneer just comes off. And so, yeah, again, as you said before, I wouldn't choose to have anyone die or suffer over this. But when, you know, we're doing the best we can to limit that, it also illustrates things that we maybe should have realized a long time ago and hopefully can finally do that. And it's why the, you know, the Hitler side of it, you know, and I'm being exaggerative in the jump ball with Hitler metaphor, but the what I see as the bad side of the situation has been so desperate to send everyone back to work and to get everyone back into a typical capitalist grind, even though it's not safe. It's no safer than it was a week ago. Nope. Like, you know, nothing has changed about the physics or the chemistry of the pandemic or the situation, but they're desperate to remind everyone what that used to be like and to pull up this propaganda of like, remember, normal life was good. Now, seeing human beings was good. Yeah, I miss that. We all miss that. But at the same time, like, for someone, to be honest, even on that level, for someone with far-flung friends, I have spent more time connecting and talking with people who I would not see more than once a year or once every 3 years in the last, you know, than normal. You know, I don't think we've stepped that up because we have this regular outlet for that. But there are a lot of people that I don't talk to more than once or twice a year, and certainly don't see very often. My New Orleans chess club, I play with them every week because I can. And so there's arguably in this fragmented world, you know, the nature of connection and bridging distances is taking on a different shape and not necessarily being as isolated. Now, I say all that, I obviously am married and not living alone. That's a huge difference. You know, there's a lot of privilege that I have in my position on this, so I've
we've got two authors and a video game / former amateur online poker player who feel so comfortable being at home all the time.
Yeah, sure.
Like, this is not a burden for any of us.
Right.
No, it's true. Although I will say that one of the things that I love to do with, you know, the kids in particular, like, in, you know, my daughter, was to be able to, you know, pick her up after school and go all kinds of places, like driving places. And that was one of the things we loved to do. And that we really can't do. You know, you can't, we've driven a couple times and gone to like a park, but we can't go to like a museum and then a bookstore and then a bowling alley. And then, you know, you can't do any of that. So that does, and all my conventions are canceled. Every convention is canceled. Right. And that sucks, because that's, I love the summer for that reason. And I can't do any of that. And I can, you know, so there is that, but yeah, no, I think you're 100% right that some of that is in play, but go on, story. I do want to
bring No. And all I'm saying is, like, and I think you guys are rightly pointing out, like, I don't think anyone wants this to be permanent, right? I think it is a useful illustrative tool. But I think a year would be okay. And I think a year might be what it takes, epidemiologically.
Yep.
I mean, obviously humans need connection. Like, this is not a sustainable way of life for the, you know, inevitable foreseeable future forever. But I think as a tool, when you see like, oh, who are really the essential workers? What are really the essential jobs? Oh, we don't, you know, a lot of people's jobs, like, and they may find fulfillment out of them and certainly get money from it, which is the whole problem of the system that requires that or whatever. Like, there may be positive benefits of it, but like, most things that most people do are not, you know, us included, are not quote unquote essential. But also part of our comfort with that is that I think we are, all three of us, aligned with an innate human creative instinct that I think everyone has, right? Like, we are lucky enough that we have been able to have the fortunate bounces in our lives to prioritize those things and fulfill it. But a lot of the people who have essential jobs doing delivery or working in food places or whatever else also have just as much creative talent and just as much creative instinct as any of us do. And, you know, if we can connect with that, that's what the human spirit and instinct is made for and does best, then, you know, hopefully we can move everybody a little bit closer to that, especially at a time, you know, if the pandemic, I mean, even 1918, certainly when bubonic plague hit, like, humanity was not in a position to automate most labor and have everybody be able to live a sustainable life if you distributed resources equitably. Mm. So it's taken some time to get there, and it's taken some bad systems to get there, but we're in that position now, right? Like, we have you know, if we take sustainability seriously instead of this ludicrous obsession with growth, like we are in a position to sustain human life fairly comfortably and fairly equitably if we make that a priority. And it still seems insane that we would do anything else. So if it takes something like this to illustrate that to us and we can do it reasonably quickly, you know, it doesn't surprise me that this moment leads to some sort of, you know, awakening or acknowledgement about the rights and importance of what people actually need.
I agree on that. I mean, I would say the just a couple things I wanted to say. First of all, one of the reasons we don't want it to be permanent, one of the many reasons, sort of regular, you know, appointments for things, you know, getting to, for example, I'm like 3 months overdue for my dentist, you know, like things that like are like parts of basic health that we can't do right now for, you know, for stuff like that. Domestic violence is way up. So this is definitely not something you want to have as permanent. However, I completely agree with you that almost again, this really does feel like a reset button. I did my last weekend, I did my annual charity event, ARVCon. Which was done to benefit this year the Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation, because one of my mods and actually a friend who did a bunch of the videos, ran a bunch of websites and all this stuff, he passed away about 2 months ago now from complications of type 1 diabetes. He's 39. And it was very unexpected. He was on dialysis, but he had been feeling better because he was on dialysis, and he lived in Canada, so he actually had a sane healthcare system,
right?
And all that. So like he had been feeling better, and then, you know, we were contacted by one of his friends that he had passed away, and we, you know, followed up on it, and, you know, indeed he had. So that was a real shock. And so we changed things up. I decided that I would change things up and make that the beneficiary. Now, I didn't know what this event was going to bring. And so I organized, as I usually do, a bunch of tabletop games, and we had giveaways, we had a bunch of corporate sponsors, whatever. So we raised $4,000, which was in the course of 3 days, three and a half days, $4,000 for this event, which was double the goal that I had set, because our record was 3,200 a couple of years ago for the Damon Runyon Cancer Research Foundation. Last year, we only made about 1,800, and that was a big economic thing going on at the time. So it didn't surprise me. And I'm like, I better set my goal 2,000, because we're in the middle of a pandemic. I mean, people are unemployed. They got other things to worry about. But not only was that not the case, it actually turned out, I think, to be the opposite. I think people were really in a good mood about it. They felt like they were taking agency. They were and so it was unbelievable to me that we had this kind of a response. And I'm not saying, you know, we've raised over now $11,000 for charity over the last few years doing that event.
Sure.
So I'm not saying that it was completely out of left field, but doubling the goal based in the middle of this is indicative to me that we are, that people felt sort of inspired and brought together by this in a way that might not have been expected. And I want to put a guy on your folks' radar screens. If you have not heard already of a Dutch historian named Rutger Bregman, this guy made a big name for himself last year at Davos, when he basically said that the reason, like he said, I don't understand what we're all doing here, because all we really need to do is just raise taxes. And he's like, all the rest of it is nonsense. Like all the stuff about, like, you know, well, with philanthropy and blah, 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 blah. He's like, philanthropy is a Band-Aid that you put on the problem. Just raise taxes on the rich. And he goes through this whole like historical reason as to why. So that was his big thing. But he's a very, very gifted writer at being able to, he speaks, you know, he is very compelling as a speaker as well. But his real gift is in writing. So he has a new book, which I've read an excerpt of, and I'm going to buy when it comes out on June 2nd, called Humankind. And his argument is that humankind is fundamentally, in fact, evolved to be friendlier and kinder to each other than the opposite. And that if you look at the experience of what evolutionary scientists and biologists and a variety of people, anthropologists, have been able to study, that they have demonstrated increasingly that the violent ones actually died off much faster than the friendlier ones. Things such as, so unusual as, I couldn't believe this. The reason we are the only members of the animal kingdom that have white in our eyeballs. There is no reason whatsoever evolutionarily that we need that. Many other, you know, species, including monkeys, gorillas, and many others, dogs, cats, have obviously eyes the way that we do, except that they don't have the white in the back of the eye. Why do we have that? There is no purpose except one. And that is that having white in the eyes makes it easier for us to see when someone is looking in towards our way. We are the only species, except for maybe chimpanzees, monkeys, and things like that, that make steady and consistent eye contact as a part of our regular behavior. So it's just, and he, you know, he talked about the actual real Lord of the Flies story. The real Lord of the Flies story is where four kids did in fact get shipwrecked on an island and survived for a year by pairing up, by working together, by being collaborative, by when they got into a fight, going to the opposite end of the island, cooling down, then coming back together, hugging it out, crying, and so on. And all four of them now survived. That's the real Lord of the Flies story. And so his point is that fundamentally humankind is good. And the reason that we believe that it isn't is that a long, long attempt at convincing us that we're not has been done by elites and power brokers. Because if you can get military dictators to make you believe that we are dangerous animals that will leap down each other's throats at any opportunity, well, then you need the military dictator, right, to keep people safe. And when you stop believing that and realize that that is all a bunch of, this is the most I've ever said bullshit, by the way, in you know one show, but it just seems to apply a lot today. All of that is just a bunch of bullshit. How compelling that is a story. And he goes through it bit by bit. He takes historical examples. He goes after the Holocaust. All examples that people will be like, well, wait a minute, isn't that incredibly naive? He's like, what's naive is to ignore science and biology and epidemiology and evolutionary science. And then he describes all these things. So I can't wait to read the full book, but that strikes me as exactly what we're talking about, is that we may be learning that we're closer to each other than we really thought we were, and that we evolved to be that way. And that we are what the people, everyone wants us to get back to work and do all these things as fast as possible. They're doing this. Is they're afraid that we've already found out that we don't need to do what they told us we did, that we don't need to hate each other the way they wanted us to hate, that we don't need to kill each other the way they told us we needed to kill, that we don't need to work ourselves to death because that's what an economy requires, that we are not just human capital stock. All of those fairy tales, they are desperately afraid that we've already figured out that that's not necessary anymore and that you can't put that genie back in the bottle. And so, yeah. Anyway, that's a bunch of my disjointed thoughts that I thought of in response to that. So, yeah.
No, I find that compelling.
It's really cool. I love reading stuff where it's just logical and it's sort of like, you may think it's naive. Let me explain to you why optimism is not naivete, actually. And there's implications too about, therefore you can't just sit around and go, okay, everything's going to be all right. It means you have to recognize that it's not hopeless, which is the way they've tried to make you believe that it's hopeless, and it's not hopeless, you know? So yeah. Speaking of hopeless, have we lost Russ to?
No, I'm here.
Okay, good.
I'm here.
Very good.
I appreciate the message. I it's hard. Like, I don't know if, I'm just closer to the shit than you guys are to feel as uplifted. Like, understandably, like, Greg, I know you're in New York and that they've dealt with a great deal in terms of the pandemic stuff. I don't know how close you are to any of the protest/violence stuff.
Not down my street for sure. Like you've had. So,
yeah. So for my part, I mean, it was uplifting to drive around the neighborhood today and see people out in the streets cleaning and sweeping and removing graffiti and like working to restore the buildings and all that stuff. And like, again, I completely agree with you that none of this should be put in front of the lives of Black men who are murdered. I guess my approach is, and just from my absorption of the media and the way that it goes, like I hear so much of that message. Like, obviously police brutality is a horrible thing. Obviously there should be police reform. Obviously we shouldn't have paramilitary equipped police departments. Like, I've been saying this since I wrote debate cases in 1997, you know?
Oh, yeah.
So like, I just kind of take all that as a given. And then I try to, and this is kind of how my mind works and why I can be kind of a provocateur in conversation sometimes, is I go, okay, yes, I'm a good progressive. I understand that, you know, systemic racism is a thing and it exists and I acknowledge it. On the other hand, if your goal is to get these things accomplished, you want to defund the police, you want more people of color in the police force, you want more progressive mayors, you want funding diverted from security to other useful things, et cetera, et cetera. Is the best tactic to get that accomplished, you know, I think the protests are great. The nonviolent protests are amazing. The fact that then they're followed by 4 to 5 hours of cops chasing people around as they smash up stores and beat the crap out of people in the street who try to defend those stores and occasionally beat somebody to death who's defending their store in town because they won't let somebody loot it. Like, is that really advancing your agenda? And I made this argument on Facebook today, by the way, and got like, holy hell from everyone in the community who's like, how dare you even bring that up? Like, in the face of what has been happening to black men and people of color, like, how dare you even bring up that your neighborhood was sacked? And I'm like, it's not about me. It's about the political will that we need to change all these things that we want to change and who we need to convince, because the far left people don't need to be convinced. They already agree that all these things need to be changed. And yet, other than in a few select cities like Portland and Seattle and Los Angeles, et cetera, like, they're not getting it done. There are too many Republican governors. There are too many Republican legislatures. Like, why is that? And it's because politically, this group is incredibly fragmented, usually can't get its story together in terms of making concrete demands for what it wants, and has this tendency to shoot itself in the foot. And this is what I was arguing on Facebook in the face of people calling me like a white supremacist for complaining that,
oh boy, well,
that like I was upset because my children were screaming and crying because, you know, 15 SWAT teams were going by our house and they were afraid. And they're like, and like, I get it. People of color are afraid every time they hear a siren. I get it. That doesn't mean that my experience of having a traumatic night while I'm thinking I'm going to have to protect my children from just like hooligans sacking the neighborhood is invalid, or that it doesn't exist, or that it isn't a thing. Because not only is it a thing for me, but it's a thing for all the people who aren't protesting right now, who are just kind of watching on TV or on the internet, and they're just trying to get a sense of what's really happening. And if the first thing they see are a bunch of people just stealing Nikes, and I'm not talking about supplies and things that you need because you can't afford medicine and food and water. I'm talking about looting the Mac store or some shit. Like, that, there's no political purpose behind that. That's just anarchy. And one thing, if we have time, I would love to talk about the composition of these various groups, because it seems like there are like five or six different groups that all have different agendas, which is why everything that's going on is so decentralized and leaderless. It's because there are literally five different movements with five different agendas going on all at once. And some of them are counterproductive and some of them are cooperative.
So, yeah, I mean,
Go on, sorry.
Oh, no. All I was going to say, because I went to Pittsburgh, and the Pittsburgh, you know, we left before, you know, as I was saying before the show, you know, we saw one police car get set on fire, and, you know, there's video that since emerged, even though we were there and saw the situation, you know, it wasn't clear what was going on at the time, because there's a lot of crowding and there is a lot of different groups. And apparently, you know, video has emerged that, you know, it was basically a white anarchist who started attacking the police car. But then there's also all these questions about, there was an abandoned police car in the middle of the protest march path, which is very strange.
The exact same thing happened here yesterday.
Right. And it's not like there was one or two cops there and then they were forced to flee. Like, it was literally abandoned. It was literally just like, in the middle of, you know, in a middle of a parking spot, in the middle of a block that there had no other cars on it anywhere that had been cleared for the protest route. So it's like, that's really, really, really weird, and really kind of obviously weird. And so, you know, and but the decentralization, I mean, when, you know, so the protest was incredible. And then there was kind of a gathering area in the center of the Duquesne campus, which is like the major, along with Pitt, is one of the major urban universities in Pittsburgh. And then a couple of people started actually giving speeches with their bullhorns, which we tried to get closer to hear, but they didn't have like great projection ability, and other people were chanting during that. And then we kind of moved on to the area where then the police car was discovered, that's in front of the hockey arena. And, you know, Alex and I were talking about it while we were there, and I was saying, you know, and I'm not, I understand why the movement wants to be decentralized and has the kind of Occupy model and avoids centralization. And I understand all of the problems with centralization and codification and kind of bureaucratization of a movement that is starting from a widespread or almost universal groundswell. But I do, in seeing it, and this was before things kind of, you know, accelerated and then the police car, which I have, you know, I have mixed feelings. I'm a pacifist about humans. I have very mixed feelings about property destruction, especially when they're representing violent institutions. You know, I think it's a hard question, but I don't, you know, I felt uncomfortable watching it, but I also don't think that it's outrageous. So it's like, it's hard to know what to feel about that. Mm-hmm. And similarly with a lot of capitalist looting, like I understand some people have individual businesses, but I also like don't think property should exist probably. So like, it's hard for me to get too bent out of shape. And obviously like if you're taking it and terrorizing people, like, you know, obviously the effect on people is what matters to me. So I have a lot of ambivalence about these feelings in general, just to kind of put a pin in that. But if you have like the energy and the solidarity and the kind of amazement that was going on with the protest movement, there needs to be some, if you're going to have these protests, in my opinion, and I'm not saying that I have any place or standing to like run things or criticize how people are doing that. I'm just trying to observe it from an organizational perspective. From my history of trying to run things and organize movements and organize people, it felt very clear to me when we were all around the area with that police car and everything had stopped and people had stopped moving in the direction they were going to because there was a big like cordon of riot police and they were looking to try to arrest people and people didn't want to go in that direction, obviously. There needed to be a culminative event, or it would have benefited greatly to have a culminative event. Now, as a former debater, it will not surprise you that my thought was speeches. Speeches tend to be the event, but there need, you know, I felt like there was a huge amount of energy and a huge amount of anger, and it needs to go somewhere and do something. It is not shocking to me at all that human nature says that if you don't have a culminative event like that, and you've built up this kind of groundswell of energy and emotion, that, I mean, it would take a miracle if not 2 to 5% of the people in that situation then turned it to an escalation of property destruction. I can't imagine.
Just could be like, oh, all right, good talk, everyone.
Right. Like, I just can't, you know, and that is what we're talking about, right? Like, we are talking about a very small percentage of the total people who are doing, who are involved in this. But like, it's just people need an outlet. People need to go somewhere. I'm someone who wants to break glass when I'm angry personally. I don't always do it, but I do sometimes. And like that is an instinctual human feeling. So of course, right? Just like, of course. And so I think if the movement is going to be, because there's been a lot of kind of lamenting and observation about like whenever there's one of these horrible incidents and it gets publicized and then it creates a movement and then people buy into it and then it becomes, there becomes enough destruction that it alienates some people and turns into a backlash, and then it all gets kind of melted back down into the status quo, which is why arguably a lot of this is coming from provocateurs who are trying to foment that. But whether it is or not, like, I think if the movement is going to take this incredible opportunity that has tragically been reached and do something with it, with this much support and groundswell of support, then I think there needs to be some kind of leadership or organization or principle of organization that says, here is where we're going to go. These are the steps we're going to do. And I will add, because this is the one thing that I've seen some people talk about, I will add at the risk of pushing buttons here, it is not to politics. It is not to a political solution, because this all started in Minnesota that has a left-wing, left-leaning Democratic governor, a far-left Democratic mayor, a 12 Democrat and one Green Party left-wing city council. And that's where all of this started, because that's how corrupt the system is. So political solutions are not sufficient. They can be part of the solution, but like, it is not just simply a matter of like, oh, it's all the Republicans, let's go for Democrats and it's all going to be fixed. Like, there has to be a larger, more transcendent
I agree with
way
that.
Of Dylan.
So I agree with that.
That's
entirely.
My soapbox. Yeah.
Yep. No, I agree with that. That still hasn't pushed any buttons for me. Yeah. I agree. in fact, I would say part of what was interesting, one of the guys that was marching along with the protesters from the police uh-huh. was in Camden, New Jersey, where there was no violence at all. Mm-hmm. And 10 years ago, what the Camden, which was, you know, if you've never been to Camden, I mean, you will know about it a little bit from your time in Jersey, your story, but Camden is not a place that anyone would have thought of as a vacation destination. It's deeply, you know, poverty stricken and, you know, lots and lots of issues in Camden, and yet no violence there. Why is that? Well, because about 10 years ago, the entire political establishment basically said, we need to get rid of, the problem is the police union. I'm a union guy. I belong to a union most of my working life. But I will be the first to admit that there is one deeply problematic union. It's the police union. And so they basically just said, they just fired everybody and they just started from scratch. And so you have a non-union police force that understands their role to be guardians and not warriors. And in fact, that's what Obama wanted to do as part of police reform, which of course Trump immediately threw out, was to create guardians and not military people. You know, you don't want military people on the streets. And that's what Russ talked about before. So anyway, there was, but you know, that's what a political system needs to do that. And regardless of who is running it, Democrat or Republican, until they face down the problem in this particular thing that we're talking about, which is relating to the police brutality, this isn't going to change. So you have to fire a lot of them and you've got to have accountability put in place. It's not enough even to just do, you know, bias training and to do implicit. It's not enough to do that. You also just have to get rid of a lot of the bad apples, and there are a lot of bad apples. Yes, there are some good cops, but there are a lot of bad ones. So you need to fire the whole crew and start fresh. Mm-hmm. And so that's a lot of it. I do want to say that just in response to some of what you suggested also, Russ.
Sure.
First of all, one tweet that just came over the line, which I just had to read. This is about Trump hiding in his bunker. There is something somewhat poetic about stoking a Reichstag fire and forgetting you live at the Reichstag, which is, I don't know, it kind of cracked me up. The Minneapolis police chief announced today, actually in the last few hours, acknowledged that the three other police that haven't been arrested yet were complicit in Floyd's death. You may think like, well, what's the big deal about that? Well, the big deal about that is the fact that the Minneapolis police chief has not made any other, you know, has been very coy about like the whole business about why haven't they been arrested. And as people were pointing out, is there any chance in the world that the police chief would have done that were it not for the fact that the protests have been loud and impossible to ignore, that it wasn't just a matter of people linking arms and singing Kumbaya around a statue. And I'm not, again, trying to invalidate what that means. But I have to say, Russ, I hear everything you've suggested. And I am a father myself and have two kids myself. And I can only imagine what it was like for you being on your front porch, right? And looking out. I told you guys from a couple of weeks ago how much it almost broke me to watch my kid having to put on a mask to go outside to play and how much that hurts. And that's not talking anywhere near the level of the immediacy of I have to be on my front porch because I'm afraid that someone's going to come in and hurt my kids. I cannot even imagine, Russ. And there is also a cultural religious aspect to this too, that you and I have talked about the experience for you of being Jewish, you know, what your family, what your grandparents went through.
Yeah. I'm strangely triggered by a rioting in my city.
You know, I can't imagine why. No, I mean, like, I, you know, all joking aside,
deep seated, unnerving about that going on.
No, I mean, like it's awful. And I'm so sorry that you had to deal with that. And I agree that that's awful, but I do want to point out that one thing you mentioned there was the fact that listening to the SWAT teams go by. So again, a couple comments. Number one, the real problem was the police and the SWAT teams, not so much the people that were going to go around and loot and pillage. A lot more of it has to do with the escalation done by people that think of themselves as mini military instead of police to protect and serve. So again, I really think the police are 80% of the problem. But the second thing is, and it's so weird to me because I was not a big Occupy Wall Street guy. I was not a fan of the tactic. I think that it kind of fell apart. Frankly, anytime you have a movement that ignores John Lewis, I don't really want to hear what you have to say in the first place. You know, John Lewis comes and wants to address your movement. You let him, he's John Lewis. You step aside and let him address your movement. So I was not an Occupy Wall Street guy. That said, though, I have to say, watching this unfold, I care so much less about the symptom than I do about the cause. So to me, the symptom is people being afraid about their property being lost. And in your case, being afraid about these riots spilling over and having an impact on your family. Again, I want to acknowledge that initially. I hear you. I'm so sorry that happened. As your friend, I can only imagine. I mean, I thought a lot about all my friends, but in particular you, because I know you were living in Cali and you were living in a place where LA knows something about riots, you know, so I'm fully aware of that. But I find myself more interested in the cause. And the cause is the constant injustice, and the cause is the breakdown of the system around us, as we discussed earlier, relating to the pandemic, et cetera, et cetera. These are the causes. And so I care so much more about the thing causing the fire alarm to go off than I care about the fire alarm. And I don't in any way mean to invalidate the fact that you are then having to hear the fire alarm, you know, creating terrible stress and anxiety for you and your family. I don't in any way, again, for the third time, I'm not invalidating that, but I just find myself interested in what created the fire. And what created the fire is centuries of injustice and centuries of inequality, racial, first of all, most of all, but then also economic and all the other things that we've talked about previously on the show. And so I find so much of my instinct is, and I feel like a lot of people that I've been listening to agree, is about addressing the cause that led us to this point. And those causes ultimately are what cause you to have to stand on your porch. And so whether the protesters are or are not doing something they should, and whether we should feel comfortable or uncomfortable about people destroying a police car, I'm almost just past giving a damn at all about that. And I'm so much more interested in, can we finally address the root cause of what happened? So it's so weird to me that I feel this way, because as I say, it's not how I would have felt myself responding even 5 years ago, but I find a great deal of sympathy, because when I stand up in front of my classrooms, I cannot tell you how many George Floyds I see, and how many Trayvon Martins, and how many Abner Louimas, and how many Breonna Taylors. I cannot tell you how many of those people that I see. And the experience of teaching those people that have the same dreams and experiences that everyone else does, except they also have the overwhelming reality that they will absolutely be discriminated against in their lives and may very possibly lose their life as a consequence of having the wrong color skin. It's very hard for me then to get worked up about property damage in LA. Not you specifically, again, for the fourth time, not you.
Okay.
But I just mean,
it's a wonderful speech and a very uplifting thing that you said. There are also old men beaten in the street in Santa Monica Boulevard today. Okay. It's not just a fucking Zara and a Target. All right.
I hear that.
Racially fueled violence against human beings going on.
I hear that.
The country right now.
I hear that.
There is a dude beaten, perhaps killed. I don't know what the result of the video that I saw was, but you know, he was defending a storefront. The looters wanted to get in. He raised a weapon. They raised a weapon, and then they outnumbered him and they like beat him within an inch of his life until he was limp on the ground. So it's not.
I hear that. It's
like
not
I said,
target. I hear you.
There are a bunch of different groups, right? There's Black Lives Matter and the people who are centrally focused on police reform and, you know, making sure that people are treated with dignity. There are Antifa and anarchists who might be part of the same group, might be two different groups, who in general want to smash, they want to do anti-capitalist behavior. They want to smash up banks and targets and, you know, destroy the New World Order. There are policemen in plain clothes trying to make the riots worse than they are by putting old model out of commission police cars in the way of riots, hoping that they get set fire. Like in the protest yesterday, people were describing an old model police car put in front of the riot. Three mysterious people who weren't with the protest like emerged from the crowd, two with skateboards that were like brand new and looked like they'd never been used before, and they just like really super efficiently set fire to this police car as if it was produced like a Hollywood movie or something like mm-hmm. that.
Yep.
Like there's incredibly sophisticated, orchestrated shit going on all over these things. And then there's like white supremacists and Proud Boys who are trying to make these things more violent because they specifically want to start a race war because they believe that with Donald Trump in the presidency, it's to their advantage to do this right now before November. And then there are just opportunists who don't care about Black Lives Matter. And this is white people and people of color who are just want to break shit and steal shit. And they don't have any allegiance to anything.
Agree.
And so all of that's going on at once. And so as noble as the Black Lives Matter people may be, and as nonviolent as they may be, and as organized as they may be, all of the other stuff makes it very hard for the American public to get the message correctly, especially given how fragmented our system of information is in terms of how people get their individual information.
I don't deny it. Nothing of what you said is wrong. I completely agree with you on so many of those fronts. It's not just Target being affected. Again, the overwhelming majority of people that are dying as a consequence of this are dying as a consequence of police action or escalation, not because of. That's, again, I just don't want to lose the forest for, you know, a couple of trees.
This would be way easier if we had, you know, one force led by Gandhi and one force led by Martin Luther King, and they were perfectly organized and nonviolent. And as soon as bad actors started doing things, all the real protesters would just sit down and observe them quietly and go, you're clearly not one of us because this is not what we agreed upon. But like, just so decentralized and so, and it's like, it's anarchical.
It's Urkel. It's Urkel. It's from, but see, the only thing I'll say about that, and then we had a long show, which is good. I mean, this has been valuable, but I do want to say, I agree with you, except the only thing I would slightly disagree on is that the anarchy that you're just like, even this, and I'm not, it's not even a disagreement. It's just a point to add on to it. Even the reality of what you've just said about who's doing what has almost immediately been called out on social media, in particular Twitter, which this is one thing that Twitter does very well, which is sort of instantaneous reaction. It's also what, it's often a problem with Twitter, but it's very good at this sort of thing, at being able to call this stuff out quickly. And one of the things that is done is it means that people respond to it much faster, so that, for example, Keith Ellison is going to be the one in charge of prosecuting the police. That's extremely smart. It absolutely should be Keith Ellison doing that, not, you know, the whatever the hell, you know, Tweedledum, whatever the hell the guy is that was the guy who was kind of like, well, we got to look at both sides and consider, you know, from a couple of, because that was his district, you know, Ellison is doing this himself, which he absolutely should do. That happened. And the fact that immediately they discovered that a large percentage of the people being arrested were from not only out of the city, but out of the state, an overwhelming number were white, an overwhelming number were well-armed. You know, like, why are you coming in Kevlar and gas masks to a protest where a bunch of people are wearing t-shirts and shorts and a backpack and a mask and a baseball cap? You know, this, so I agree with you that there's a lot of other stuff going on, but the difference to me is that that gets called out very fast and is then getting responded to very quickly on the ground. This is, again, the whole thing about we're in the middle of it. This only really started to blow up on Monday. And if you already see an example where if the Minneapolis police chief is saying that those officers are complicit today, those officers are going to be arrested in the next day or so. And that doesn't end things, but it means that things change radically, it seems to me, in terms of the accountability factor, which is partially a consequence of, I hate to say this, Russ, but Story will agree with me here, having a lot of people who can film you at all times. This is where Story's death of privacy may work in our favor.
I was going to bring that up at some point, but it felt like, you know, tertiary to the point.
But I mean, you know, as a supplement there, I guess. Right. And then, so I don't know. Again, I really am not trying to play Pollyanna here. I just don't, my sense of it has just been that people are calling this stuff out faster and are more, again, maybe because they just have more time. This is the big thing about time. This is the last thing I want to say about it. We have more time, many of us do, not all essential workers, obviously, but many of us have had a little more time and at least a little more focus. Maybe it's just stir crazy, being bored, as you said, Russ. And so we're able to sort of note this more. And that means that people are able to do things like say, this sounds like a bunch of crap. Like, this sounds like someone is trying to set this up. Or this, is this really what the protesters are doing? Like, what are the protesters protesting about? Oh, really? Because it sounds to me like these other people are just maybe not part of the real action. So we need to separate it. Like, this discussion of saying four or five groups, it just feels different to me. So.
On Twitter, that the protesters in many different cities keep stumbling upon like a giant pallet of bricks just sitting in the middle of the street in a fake construction site with no construction going on.
Right.
It just seemed to be like there.
Like Story with his police car that was left in the middle of. Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. But the fact that we know that is indicative of the fact that social media has done its job here. They've also taken a lesson from the Hong Kong protesters, you know, and a lot of their methods of, you know, this stuff, which again, it's trying not to co-opt the Hong Kong movement, but maybe solidarity and learning from other protesters that were successful. So I don't know, you know, if it just feels to me like there is a reaction on the part of the governors, not the governors of the states, but the political governors, right? Or the leaders, right? That they need to be afraid of the governed. And they do. The government must be afraid of its citizens if it is to function properly. And so that's the classic idea. You shouldn't be afraid of your government. The government should be afraid of the governed. The guy hiding in the bunker is afraid of his people. The Minneapolis police chief suddenly saying three police officers are complicit are afraid of the people in the streets. They're afraid. And we want them to be afraid. We don't want them to lash out. We don't want them to be violent. But we do want them. And I'm not talking about America writ large. I'm talking about those people. Particularly the leaders, we want them to be afraid and act accordingly, not with overwhelming military force, because that will create more reasons for them to be afraid, but with overwhelming understanding of, I can't do what I would normally do under these circumstances. I need to do something that will allow the people to feel some sense of justice. That's what we want. So what we don't want is people like you feeling afraid and people like old men in the street getting beaten down and feeling afraid. We do not want that. We don't want being afraid of each other. But this goes back to the thing I was saying about Rutger Bregman. It is in the interest of those who would be military dictators to convince us that we need to be afraid of each other. What we need to do is to convince them that they should be afraid of us and that everyone, all of the others, should not be afraid of each other. That is what solidarity means. You know, it's not a slogan in a class. So anyway, I hear you and I'm sensitive to that. It just, to me anyway, just personally, it does feel different. And that said, I don't want you to be sitting out on your porch having to watch people, you know, running by and being afraid for your kids. Nothing can make up for that except to say that to keep my suggestion, which is to try to keep the focus on those to blame here, which is not the protesters, but the thing that they are protesting. And also to get the sense that I don't think this is a long, long running thing. I think that this is something which could create real change. And I think we need to go dunk on Hitler, I think, is what Story is.
That's fair.
Is saying. We've gotten way long, guys, but yeah. this was a super, super great conversation.
So, just before we close, I just have one question to ask. Given everything that you know about 2020, would you say, op choice, this is a good time to have a child or a bad time?
Wait, is there is there news?
Is that
there,
a thing?
I mean, I just want to get your opinion before I know whether I should tell you or not.
Holy shit.
Wow. Do you realize that this is what the Mep Report really is for now? It's just for us to announce children being born and like marriages and like being how to protect.
I mean, I found out both of your first children on a show, so it only seemed fair.
You actually had a direct appearance from one of my children, dude. I mean, first of all, congratulations.
Thank you.
What's the how long? I mean, do we have a sense of? Do we have a vague? ETA?
Yeah. It's pretty early yet. So we may have to delay the show based on public stuff, or we can cut it off or something. But no. Oh,
well, yeah, you tell me. I mean, we don't.
No. We'll figure it out. I mean, we're gonna go public with it pretty soon. But December, mid December is the.
Wow.
So yeah.
Congratulations, man.
Thank you.
Having children has been extremely difficult, but enormously rewarding. And like, you know, Senevine is the light of my life. And mm-hmm. Kalen is just a wonderful free spirit, you know, like, and I'm looking forward to, as he gets older, learning even more about him being the light of my life too. This arguably, I'm going to make a controversial statement that I don't know how Russ feels. I'm interested to see what he thinks.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that this is one of the better times to have a child for this reason.
Okay.
First of all, by the time your child is old enough to know what's happening, it would be nice to think that we will be past the pandemic and we will be past some of these things.
Sure.
And you will have an opportunity for them to shape a more just world. And if you want to create children that were brought into the world, not just for the sake of, well, you have kids because you have kids, but because you wanted to shape life differently and do it with people that you care deeply about that are tied to you some way, I can think of no better time to do it. So I would actually say, and it's going to sound bizarre, but I think this is a better time in some ways, because it is a time when you can feel like, my daughter was born when Obama was, you know, inaugurated, and
sure,
and now we got this guy person hovering in his bunker, you know, like when she was old enough to know. So for her, she's kind of like, she's, her political trajectory has been kind of downhill for a bit until she can recover. For you, I feel like it might be a different experience. So I think it's a good time, but who knows? That may just be me talking. What do you think, Russ?
Yeah.
I think it's a wonderful thing. It's always a good thing. I don't know why so many people are down on having children. It's a thing with the new generation. I mean, I think it's...
Sustainability may be part of it.
I mean, like, yeah, the argument is couched in environmentalism, but I think it's also just like the financial situation of most people of that age kind of prevents them from even doing it. And so they kind of justify not doing it that way to be like, well, I don't really want to burden the world with the child. But I'm like, this is all we have. This is what the world is. It's people having children and teaching them things and sharing traditions, etc. I'm in the thick of it, man. I've got a 1-year-old and a 3-year-old right now.
Yeah,
for sure.
And they're both terrific. I don't like I said, I've had it easy in terms of the quarantine time, just because like I get to spend time with them and my family, and like that's really all I need. So so I think that it's a great time to do that and to build a friend.
If nothing else, I'm increasing the number of people that I can see on a daily basis by 100%.
Yeah, so it's a DIY area. You got to make
that your own is amazing. Friends. Exactly. It's like, well, if I can only see people in my family, let's increase that family.
Listen, man, all the games that were 3 to 7 people are only. Away from being legitimate options, you know, like your kid will be obviously smart and ahead of the curve, and you know that'll be it is life is a celebration of, like, I was reading an article about this, about someone talking about watching this fawn, this deer, be born just like on the edge of the woods, and then the deer, you know, sort of stumbling around wide-eyed and sort of stumbling after its mom, which was standing right there, obviously, stumbling into the woods after its mother, and how, you know, life proceeds even in those moments. And there is something wondrous about that. And I've always thought, and the answer to sustainability is, when you have a child, there is no telling the extraordinary qualities that that child, especially when raised properly, can possess and what benefit that brings to the world. And that, what an extraordinary idea that you can shape history through the shaping of a person. And if you don't do it, then who else will do it and will shape those people? And I don't care if that sounds arrogant or egotistical, whatever. Like, I think that you have a chance to kind of advance your feelings about what is right and wrong and about how the world ought to be conducted, not by living your life through your child, but by creating a vibrant, curious, morally, you know, consistent, a child who has a sense of right and wrong and wants to try to help people and do so in a way that is fulfilling and happy for them also. And man, that's the best act of creation in a way you could be involved in. So congratulations, man.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I appreciate it.
It's about time, by the way. Jesus Christ, I had to produce four Met reporters, and we just took 15 years before you're like, all right, I guess.
Well, you know, I mean, I'm 40. I mean, that is, you know, that is part of the equation.
Yeah, Sturr's biological clock was really
ringing. Right. Well, you can question the, like, you know, whatever of a pandemic, because we're trying in a pandemic, but it's like, you know, you start doing math and it's like, yep. I don't want to be 65 at a high school graduation. Yep. Like, we've got to get on this train.
Yeah.
You know, at a certain point, like, you don't want to be the mistaken for grandpa. In the,
you realize, I just thought about that when you said that. Yeah. I'm like, okay, no, wait a minute. All right. Kaylin's going to be four. First of all, Kaylin's going to be four next week, incidentally, if we want to talk about how time goes. But so, okay. Wow. So he'll graduate 14 years from now. So I will be, I'm going to be 60. I'll be 61 though.
Mm. Okay. I'll be 61. But that's not
65. So I'll be,
you're good.
60 is the new 40.
60. Exactly. Right. And I'll
especially if you clear the pandemic, you'll feel so much younger.
Oh yeah. Like, right? We will be the survive. I'm Mad Max, man. Like, I mean, that's, I'll be driving around with my flame shooting guitar. But anyway, yeah, no, but congratulations, man. That's great.
Thank you.
See, we've talked about danger, horror, dark times, but also hope, optimism, and story's going to have a child. And of course, we will immediately need to know details about name. You know, we'll need to know all the details about the name. And
what the hell, man? This can't be the darkest Met report now.
Right, <it's not. laughs> See, I saved it.
I think someone said something about going up. This is nowhere to go but up. I just think I said.
Yeah. No. So, I mean, Well, that's the thing, right? Like, we had 2 hours of doom, and so then I had to be like, so what's the worst thing you could possibly do with a doomed planet? Make more people.
No. Move away from doom.
Right.
Now the doom will pass with the rising of the chosen one, which is Story's child.
Oh dear.
No pressure though.
And we're back at darkness. Yeah.
If you folks like what you heard out there and stuck with us through a very long show, and we're sorry, but it has been dark and
you have time on your hands. We're not
sorry. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, what exactly. else are you doing besides listening to Met Reports? Come exactly. on, don't pretend.
You're at this point, you're just like, I was just running out of content, and so we brought you
the
more.
The fourth time you're watching Friends, we're way better than that.
Exactly. Please let us know what you thought. Please get back to us. Give us your feedback. Spread the word about the Met Report. Please stay safe. Send your congratulations and name suggestions to story@metreport.com. And, you know, and let
how
us know what you think.
How about Novella Clayton?
I think that's a good one. Tale Chapter Clayton. That'll be great. Say goodbye, everybody.
All right, keep it real. Stay safe. Yeah.
I think we said all the words we could. We were like, you want us to say more words? More words? Hey,
we're all in this together.
Yes. As he shot past, I heard him say, she can't fly, but I'm telling you, she can run the pace of a kangaroo. But I don't, she can't fly, but I'm telling you, she can run the pace of a kangaroo. Well, there is a moral to this ditty, um-ba-da-da-da-da-da. Thrush can sing, but he ain't pretty, um-ba-da-da-da-da-da. Duck can swim, but he can't sing, nor can the eagle on the wing. Emu can't fly, but I'm telling you, he can run the pants of a kangaroo. Well, the kookaburra laughed, and he said, it's true, um-ba-da-da-da-da-da.